Would you bet a few thousand dollars that you could sink an 8-foot putt? What about 10 grand that you could win a drag race against a Camaro with 1,000 horsepower? If you bet $2 million, could you bet it all on one football game? Maybe you wish you could, but you probably wouldn't. Gamblers is about the people who did. From the Ringer Podcast Network, listen to Gamblers Season 2 on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200 or 2 million, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me on the other line, buying Rycan, selling Fast Aid, it's Andy Greenwald.
Chris, it is great to see you. I'm sorry it's been a minute. It's been real tough to coordinate the time zones because I live in Denmark. You're back in Los Angeles. I still haven't bought a power adapter, so I can't plug in anything.
Oh, right.
So I think I'm at about 8% on all my devices. So let's hit it and hit it hard.
But isn't it like you should go solar because isn't the sun up for like 11 hours each day or 12 hours every day? I guess the sun's up at 12 hours every day here too, right?
Yeah, this, it's a thing about Earth. You're doing great.
Andy, you're back in Los Angeles. I'm back in Los Angeles. We're in the same time zone and we're in the same headspace, man. Mm-hmm. We're here to talk about content. We could talk about whatever you want. We could talk about like our various travels across the planet. When Sean was doing his Telluride breakdown and he was like going through all the movies he saw, it just felt like right. He lives such a purpose-driven life. You know,
he does.
And you and I have such like aimless wandering, you know, and when we go on these trips, I don't think we come back with such like news from the front about what's going on in pop culture. Like I didn't find out anything about Don't Worry, Darling in England, you know, like
they were talking about it there.
I wasn't able to get to the bottom of it. So I was just wondering, do you have anything you want to report from your Scandinavian sojourn?
Well, first of all, great place. We should all live there. Second, the brand is strong, Chris. I just
brand?
Want you to know that our brand is strong. I want to tell you an anecdote that there's no way this is a brag. It's a brag, but I dined at Noma. Some say the best restaurant in the world. Some say the second best. I dined there
if it's not the best, is there another like this one's the best?
I think Mini Kebab in Glendale unseated it. Thanks to my vote. At the last second. But I'm not kidding. The reason I dine there is not because I'm like an American Express Centurion member or like an international bon vivant like you. It's because Ben Liebman, who works with the chef Rene Redzepi, is a fan of our podcast. So I was able to go. I had a reservation. I mean, I paid. This isn't one of those things. This isn't like, you know, this is no payola here. But what I wanted to mention was while the courses were coming, beautiful, thought-provoking, interesting food, kombucha mother steak. What do you think about that?
I don't even
marigold
know what that
flower
is.
Tempura. I'm just going to say words in an order until you respond. But in between courses, I don't know, 6 and 7, I felt a tap on my shoulder and my neighbor leaned over and said, I'm sorry to interrupt your meal here at the finest or second finest restaurant in the world.
Non-kebab daddy.
Non-kebab based cuisine. Yeah. But I'm a huge fan of the pod and I'm from Philly.
Oh, that's great.
At Noma. At NoMa. And I'm so sorry to the gentleman who was there with his wife. He was very nice. They were both great. They said they've been listening to our pod on the way to NoMa, almost as an aperitif. And I wish I could repeat his name. It was really cool. That was a great, the whole night was a great experience, but that was wonderful.
I wanted to ask, like, when you're out, and I assume that this was an aspect of the meal, like, and you're out foraging, right? Like, you're out there, you're in the dirt, you're looking for the microgreens.
That's what I do when I travel through Europe. You know what I mean? Like, I put on my wellies and I just wander out into nature and I see what I come back with, culturally speaking.
Was there any chatter on the trails?
Right.
About the streaming wars? Was anybody just like, what do you make of LOTR ROP first two eps? You know, do you think that the brighter and more idealistic, optimistic version of this fantasy right. world, how does it contrast with HOTD?
No, it's because I was in Denmark and the apotheosis, like the highest fantasy imaginable is Borgen, in which an environmentally conscious liberal woman becomes prime minister. You know what I mean? Like that is, she's their Galadriel. That's the difference there. And by the way, I did not do any Borgen content because I didn't make it to the building. Like I had a whole thing. I was gonna, you know, kind of pivot into it.
On your Instagram?
Yeah. I was gonna go to the building and do some
and just say talk to a bunch of people.
Well, I did say talk to a lot of people and they say, you're welcome. They do not want to hear talk from the likes of me.
So you were not able to join me last week. I had Mal on to talk about Lord of the Rings and House of the Dragon. And
that must have been like pulling teeth for her. I can't believe you got her to do that.
She was just rolling from our Talk the Thrones episode. So I was like, let's keep the energy. I was curious whether or not you wanted to share any thoughts on last week's House of the Dragon. I suppose we could also hit that when we do next week's episode, next Monday's episode off of episode 4. But I was curious whether or not you had any larger thoughts on now that
my biggest thing is that Otto Hightower is truly the Picasso of the trade machine when it comes to regal dynasties. You know what I mean? Like, I know Bill gets a lot of credit for it, but when he's just looking at the big board and he's just like, this 15-year-old could marry her infant brother and that would solve all of your problems. Maybe you just throw in a couple unprotected firsts.
Yeah, he's like Kevin Garnett after the Celtics won. Anything is possible!
Yeah, but Kevin Garnett mixed with Daryl Morey.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like seeing the whole thing. No, I think maybe we should pivot to next week. I enjoyed the episode. Again, I do feel like maybe this is just being, you know, I don't keep kosher, but I get it. Like maybe so that's why I'm a little just not into the whole crab thing.
Maybe
like,
that's why his whole plan. Why seems you like a little the new Hulu show The Patient too?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll come to that. But yeah, like I still don't quite get the 3-episode buildup of a guy who drops sea monkeys on people's faces and then hides in caves and then just gets sliced in half. I didn't quite get all that. But I do think it's going to be interesting going forward to talk about the House of the Dragon next to Rings of Power.
Yeah.
Which I've had, you know, we could talk about it next week. But like I had such a dramatic whiplash reaction where I was so negative on the pilot. And I can't tell if it was because of the content of the show or because of what it says about
the pilot of Rings of Power.
Yeah. Versus being honestly kind of charmed by the second one, which really shocked me. So
yeah.
I'm actually glad the shows are paired because they make for an interesting play. So no, where did you need me? Which wall did you need me on when you were talking to Mallory?
No, you know what? Because I was really, I threw myself off because I came into this and I was just, I think I was pretty skeptical about Rings of Power. And I think I have some pretty controversial opinions about the cinematic value of Hobbits that's been discussed pretty thoroughly in various like social media platforms. But like, I was kind of surprised by just how well done I thought the Rings of Power was and how like kind of swept up in it I got, especially the Galadriel stuff. And you know, I think that there's like a degree of high fantasy to it that's like a little bit lost on me, you know?
Yes.
It's very much written in the sort of in that style where it's like everything is about lightness and dark. It's politics.
It's like me looking at a menu in a restaurant. You know, it's like age long battle between light and dark. Only this candle can get me to the main course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Dude, I feel like I'm really having a crisis of like how often I feel compelled to use my flashlight on my phone to see the menu. and then like just not wanting to be that guy who like just ruins the vibe with this piercing bat signal going through the crowd of the, but like ultimately like I'm getting like the tips of my fingers are burning off because I'm holding candles up to these goddamn menus so they could say like whole damn fish, you know, like
are you the commissioner Jim Gordon of the small plates restaurant? Is that what you are?
But
you're like, this
I mean?
Is a symbol of hope?
It's like, Chris, at least you can kind of just guess what's going to be on any California menu, and you'll be like, I'll have the Branzino.
As you know very well, better than almost anyone else, like the number one topic for our, I guess we should charge for some of this Patreon that we're not doing, would just be my concern over my failing eyesight. And I love to talk about it. Probably need glasses. Still haven't made an appointment with your guy, Dr. Bandekar. It's a long story. We're 4 months into this delicate tango. One day I'm going to get in there. And I mentioned this to people other than you, people in my family, and they're like, should
you be
driving? Are they
as into it as I am? Yeah.
They're much
more into
it. Yeah. My younger daughter is like, you would look bad wearing glasses, so don't get them. I'm like, you just started kindergarten, relax. Two, they're like, should you be driving? I'm like, yes, I can see everything in the world. The one thing I cannot see is the wine list at any restaurant in the world after 7 p.m. Like, I cannot. It is just, it looks like the symbols carved on Sauron's shit to me at a certain point in the evening. Okay, but back to Rings of Power. The reason I kept saying I thought it was an interesting comparison is because, and maybe why I reacted strongly to the first one, was I deeply do not care about this high fantasy realm. I've not read these books. I feel like I'm aging out of the elf demographic. I have serious questions.
Not. You're entering elf prime.
Oh, that's right. That's right. As an elf.
In the first episode, Galadriel's like, and then 100 years later, and she looks great. She hasn't aged a day.
Here's my thing.
She is reading menus from the top of the mountain and being like, try the Sancerre.
Yes.
It's dry.
I came from a time before restaurants. If you had lived that long, and continued to live that long, could you not develop a hobby? Could you not take a moment away from your endless struggle, battling the forces of darkness, to create music or crime fiction or something? Because my thing is, you're 20,000 years old and you get on a boat. I get that you're not going to act like the Lonely Island in T-Pain, but you're also not going to just stand there while you sail into infinity. You don't have anything better to do. They're so boring. All that life for what? That's my issue. But it also
they
all the backstory.
They just do so much realm guarding. You know what I mean? Like the realm is always on its toes and they have to, you know, like they always have to like make sure the realm is good.
Chris, no one asked them to. You know what I mean? We all have people like that in our lives, right? It's like we're good. We're just some people tilling the soil. We'll be dead before you think about what to say next. It's fine. We don't need you. But so I in the whole first episode that basically was a, I was looking for the skip recap button for 65 minutes of the first episode of a series. But then you get to the second episode and all of a sudden you have some things that are woefully missing from House of the Dragon.
Ooh.
Like.
Speak on it.
Friendship. Oh. Or people, whether they are elves and dwarves, acting like they've met before and care about each other.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Scenes of people talking about things that aren't about the patriarchal rites of succession, but rather about, you didn't come to my wedding.
That's right.
And at that wedding, my family wasn't massacred. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a dwarf guy is what I'm saying, which I did not realize. So I really appreciated that. Like, I just thought there was more humanity in the Elrond, what's his name? Prince?
Which
Prince
guy?
Durin.
Oh, Durin. Yeah, right. I didn't even know who you were referring to for a second.
Then in three episodes of HOD so far, or even, you know, I know earmuffs to you, but like the Harfoots and the Fireflies and the big guy that looks like Bill Heck from The Old Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Yelling, like that had some magic and wonder to it. And it did make me feel, you know, interested and hopeful and engaged in a way that the Game of Thrones universe, which continues to just, and I think this is the project, it is an exercise in nihilism ultimately, right? Like, human beings, whether they have bleach blonde hair and dragons or not, are relentlessly inevitably terrible. Like that is George R. Martin's lesson to us, I feel like, which sometimes is artfully done and sometimes is less artfully done and sometimes is interesting and compelling. But it felt nice to be in a universe where that wasn't necessarily a given.
Where fireflies can dance around,
Yeah, so but I just couldn't believe that I liked it, honestly, considering how much I disliked the first one.
Why don't we talk about some shows that do have some humanity? You want to do that?
We've done a lot of media consumption since we last podcasted.
We have, and we've done some in tandem, right, where we've watched shows that, like, you know, the other likes, you know, we both are like, we're up on that. So we're up on The Patient on Hulu, FX on Hulu. We're up on the magisterial second season of Reservation Dogs, which we can talk about.
We're also we also both watched The Firm on airplanes recently, I think.
I mean, I've just assumed that I'm always watching The Firm. I watched Interstellar, thought it was really held up, thought it really like played well on a plane.
I watched The Batman on a plane.
Didn't you? I don't think you'd like that, right?
I was just letting you know I'd watched it. I just wanted you to know.
But where do you want to start? Do you want to start with industry? Do you want to start with The Patient? Do you want to start with Reservation Dogs? What is like the most pressing thing for you? What's the show that feels the most urgent?
Probably we should do industry because that's our regular and we love it. And then we could touch on some of the other things that we've watched. Because I also wanted to mention, give a small plea to the underseen Paper Girls on Amazon. So yeah, let's talk about industry. Why don't you set us up?
Yeah, I would just say that this show has, you know, as a lot of people have commented on social media, that there is like a feeling of this show like kind of taking another step as the second half of the season goes on. And I would certainly agree with that. I'm a little bit self-conscious because I feel like every time I talk about industry, I'm like, is it better than Sopranos? Did Martin Scorsese or Michael Mann direct this episode? So I'm trying to be chill. There were so many things I loved about this, sort of the meme stocks episode. You know, it was a lot of Reddit investing. There was, I thought, like a wonderful Gus episode in a season where I think it was taking a little bit of time for like the Gus plot to circle back around to maybe the main story, which is obviously like this Rican fast aid telehealth, somewhat, you know, behind the scenes collusion of like whether it's going to be this brick and mortar business that Amazon might buy, whether it's going to be simply telehealth and brick and mortar is going to go by the wayside, and who's going to benefit from that. Is it going to be your PeerPoint? Is it going to be these various other like firms and companies involved? Is it going to be Jesse? Where will Harper work after all of this? And, you know, my major takeaway from this was that Conrad and Mickey do such like an artful job at painting these portraits of people so that you understand what they are going through, even if you do not understand what they are doing. Yeah. And so I was like, I think I have like three different text message threads with three different people who know more about money than me, kind of trying to parse out what Harper was trying to do with Jesse's short position. And I think I understand it now. And also like whether she knew DVD was listening in on the phone call or whether she kind of was doing it to bait DVD and all this other stuff. But at the end of the day, I just think that Harper and Yaz are two people who, and I think I've used this trope before, but are like, they really don't start feeling anything at the blackjack table until they're down $500, you know? Like for Harper, like it is an action is the juice kind of situation where she needs to kind of be on that roller coaster. And she sees that clearly enough about herself that she tries to identify that as the reason why Jesse is interested in her, which I thought was like a very fascinating character twist. And then for Yaz, as soon as she finds out that this relationship, which seems so illicit and so exotic, is actually kind of vanilla because it's sanctioned by Celeste's wife, she's like, oh, like this isn't, maybe isn't as hot, but maybe isn't as like part of my self-conception as a character. It doesn't go along with that right now. And
also it's positional, not in a sexual sense, but almost like in a Rishi sense in that, like, you know, they took an aggressive position and it's going to work out under the terms that the deal was negotiated under. And it's bled dry of romance or emotion or that illicit thrill. I agree with that reading.
The thing I was going to ask you though, is that this episode ends with Harper going into Eric's office and essentially being like, let's be a package deal and let's go to market with just the two of us. And, I mean, presumably maybe Jesse as our client, but it's always kind of a thrill to watch shows drive off the cliff a little bit. So the idea of these people leaving PeerPoint, and I don't think it was an accident that there was a madmanism at the end of this episode, because Mad Men famously was very good at sort of being like, everything you thought you knew about this show is gone, you know, and now we're going to do this. Is that what industry is doing right now?
I think it might be, and I think it knows what it's doing. And I say this not just because we know Conrad and Mickey, but also because we know Conrad and Mickey are huge Mad Men fans. Conrad has been known to post the odd Mad Men meme or six, often with some completely inscrutable Liverpool football reference draped over it.
Yeah.
But yeah, exactly. Inscrutable to some of us. And by the way, I understand the caveat you made about praising the show. I feel like our listeners should understand where I'm coming from, the position I'm taking, which is that the other week in London, you private potted with Mickey and Conrad. Three people together in London, all three declined an invitation to dine at Noma the same night. That's what you guys were doing. So I get it. No, that's cool. It's cool. But I think it also adds my praise. It, you know, it gives my praise a certain valence that maybe it wouldn't have had before.
Sure.
The Mad Men thing at the end, yes. One of the most beloved and famous episodes of Mad Men was called Shut the Door, Take a Seat. And it was the episode where the firm splits, basically. They make a hotel room arrangement to start something new. And Eric, I think they paraphrase, I think he changed just one word, but otherwise says that title of the episode verbatim. Mm-hmm. And I was thrilled by that. I was thrilled by it not just because we love Mad Men and we love this show's ability to pay tribute to and play fast and loose homage with things that we adore, but I was thinking on it more deeply and I really feel like industry is a new generation show. And I don't mean that in the sense that it has a cast of young people that are, you know, were unknowns when it started and are all bound for glory, or even for Mickey and Conrad, who hopefully will be creating things that we'll enjoy for years to come. But it is absolutely a generational demarcation in terms of TV involvement and fandom. Because I think a lot of the shows that we still praise and love, I mean, most explicitly, like Better Call Saul, are DNA connected to shows that came before. You know, we're all the things that we praise as new and groundbreaking often had their roots in things that we ascribe to an older generation. I mean, take it back 20 years and Matt Weiner himself, right, writing his Mad Men script while staffing on The Sopranos. He was part of that generation, and so his show wasn't so much, you know, it was evolved from or descended from. Mickey and Conrad, not just living 3,000 miles away from LA, but didn't work in TV before. And I feel like this show is absolutely a product of what they watched in this previous generation, but pointing forward in a way. You know, I think they're using the influence in a pretty, pretty exciting and groundbreaking way. Like, this isn't Mad Boys and Girls.
Sure.
Right? But it is absolutely, it exists because of the precedent that Mad Men set. But it does feel unique and distinguishable from that in a way that I find really thrilling. To your other point, Chris, can you share your contacts that know about money? I feel like I should spend less time thinking about elves and more time
about
understanding what shorting means. Because I think I get it. In the same way that I, quote, get international football every 4 years.
The question is, does it matter within the context of the show whether you completely understand it? And like, and I think at least on first pass, like I've been to Prague, understand shorting. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of can't believe it's legal, but let's just leave that aside. It seems like that would encourage some bad behavior in certain sectors, but I definitely like understood it. It seemed like Harper was trying to pull off like a triple axel and like landed 2.5. You know what I mean? In terms of figure skating speak. Like, it seemed like she was trying to pull a very elaborate move.
Yeah.
And fuck Rishi over. Like, she definitely was doing that and that's what that hand gesture, which is going to be like this iconic moment for that character, is her like, I had never seen that before, but the thing where they are doing like the hold and then there is like the down or up. And I guess she throws like a symbol at Rishi that's like, now it's actually a sell rather than a buy, right?
Don't write me. So
my point is that it doesn't matter. My point is that like the drama is so obvious that the details are kind of like an icing.
you can use whatever analogy you want, whether it's watching a telenovela if you don't speak Spanish or going to see a Shakespeare play if you haven't read the play previously.
Right.
But there is kind of a, this is a genuine human thing. I think that there is a freedom when your mind can detach from the language. And when they get into their bubbles and they're just talking about stuff I don't understand, there's a purity in this for me. I truly don't get it. But I also understand it deeply.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens at that moment is the words become irrelevant and I'm reading performance, which has been just exceptional across the board this season. I'm listening to the music of what they're saying as opposed to the specifics, which is a credit to the writing and how hard those guys work on it and how well edited it is around the scripts that they wrote. And more than anything else, I think I'm receiving, like a radio tower, like the emotion of the mm-hmm. scene. Like I understand the stakes for the character. And so broadly speaking, I understood that not only was everything that Harper did in this episode a response to what happened in Berlin and her own, you know, once again, the, and I use this intentionally, snow globe of her emotional life shaken up again, but she was also told that her Pierpoint, as she knows it, is done. That she has been chosen, right, to go back to New York once right. this desk is folded.
Right.
But that this version of it doesn't exist anymore. And that's not okay with her. So she has chosen to attach herself to the great whale, right? And not the boat anymore.
Yeah.
So she's trying to, in that moment, she knows Pierpoint's done. So she's scuttling her career there and her relationship with the people that she sits at the desk
so
with.
So you saw that as an alpha act of self-destruction rather than like,
no, it's both. She's destroying her career at Pierpoint, which to her is done already. And she is proving herself to Jesse that she is, her allegiance is to him. I mean, she already had taken a step in that direction with the Goldman Sachs thing the week before.
Yeah.
Right. Telling him to take his business for this little side hustle elsewhere. She's trying to prove that she is invaluable to one person, not one institution. And it seems like it all kind of backfires because she does it, sets fire to her existence at that desk and DVD and everything else. But then it also backfires because the GameStop dorks, I mean, all the ADR, the Rishi lines in the background about the people doing this just
are great.
Gold, just yeah. print them, put them on a wall somewhere. None of it works. So, but because
yeah.
she always is, she's nothing if she's not, you know, treading water ferociously, then she goes to Eric.
That scene is so amazing. I mean, I love almost every high tension Harper is making a trade scene that they do in this show. I think they've realized that that is essentially like putting Kevin Durant on the left wing and letting, or right wing and letting him cook a little bit. But the difficulty in, I guess it's blocking, but blocking is typically like a visual term. I mean, the idea that Harper is talking on a phone with Jesse, who is also on a phone, and DVD is surreptitiously listening to them. So you're getting these cutaways to him pretending to be like, what's going on? But in real life, he's like actually listening to her. Then you're getting these cuts to Rishi, who is being played by her and getting goaded into trying to extract a pound of flesh from Jesse. And meanwhile, Rob is just sort of innocently looking on in the background. And then right before all this, you have that Yaz comes over and is like, you know, yeah. I know I'll only be like a floor away, but like, you know, it's, well, I'd love to see you. And she, and what's Harper's line? It's not a very big building, you know, like it's really good. Like the way that she's just kind of like, you need to get the fuck away from me because I'm dealing with like $450 billion here.
I don't want to not mention the Rob piece though, because last week's episode, which I don't think I got a chance to talk about with you, like I loved it. Such a great performance by Harry Lauddy, but also such a great, thoughtful treatment of a character who has his own self-destructive issues, but is in awe, right, of the Hindenburg that is Harper in full flight. Like just the cutaway to him with the yeah. emotional history we have with him, like he would never do this. He will wake up in a pile of his own sick in front of his father's flat, but he won't do this. You know what I mean? And that moment of like him looking at someone that he has so much in common with and empathy for, but is also just a gulf away from his own potential for behavior it's just so artfully done. And that's the only, that you only get that in a series as well constructed as this. But the bigger question behind all of this is how far are these guys willing to push it? So is this the end of Pierpoint? Like, will Eric and Harper hit the open market and settle in someplace else? Is the aperture going to get bigger where Yaz will be at Pier Point, but Eric and Harper will be at a rival
But
bank
Gus
somewhere?
Will be in conservative government and, you know, yeah, exactly. Like, do you follow these threads all over the place, or do you have to have this bank is... or this firm is what unites them, right?
I think what's interesting is it's a test case for just where we are with storytelling, not just in terms of the history of shows like Mad Men, which have continued to, you know, actively pushed against our conception of TV as a repetition machine. But I think they've learned that lesson, that like Eric can't keep getting soft fired.
Right.
Right. Like there's a trajectory.
Well, also
here.
Presumably Harper can only lose so much money in spectacular fashion before somebody's like, you know, maybe cut off this lady's phone line.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Right. This is enough, which is also baked into these characters, which is Yasmin doesn't need to be doing this, which makes her interesting and compelling. Uh-huh. Rob and Harper need to, both emotionally and financially. I mean, they could potentially get other jobs, but in the scheme of things, they need to work.
Well, this is why workplace dramas and workplace comedies are such a never-ending resource on a planet of which there are no never-ending resources, apparently.
Apparently not, no.
But I was thinking about this sort of, you know, obviously there's been a lot of like discourse about like the idea of returning to the office and what offices really, like what purpose they serve and whether or not they're actually modes of control and all these different ideas that you can agree with or disagree with. But in terms of what they act for as drama or the place that they as like a setting for drama or a setting for comedy, it's just really amazing to see a situation where in almost every other walk of your life, you'd be able to separate yourself from people. It's only family and work where you're kind of forced to engage with. If Harper and Yaz have a falling out, they're still 20 yards away from each other every single day. If Kenny and Yaz have this history, she still has him over her right shoulder almost every day. You know, the sort of hazing rituals, the hostility, the feelings of duplicity, like all that stuff that's in the air at this place is so rich for storytelling. And it's believable because these people are getting really well compensated to come to work and endure this, you know? So I just watching the show, which has really thoughtfully engaged with, does Harper even want to be in this building at all? As like a return to the office kind of thing. I just thought it was kind of fascinating to consider like all the little storylines that come out because these people are forced to be together.
Well, and I think one of the things that the show should be commended for in its second season is allowing the waves of other ways of existing to lap at the shore of it.
Yeah.
Meaning specifically Gus and Kenny, who both had tour de forces in this episode. The Gus trajectory is fascinating. They found a clever way to keep him tethered to this story, not just because of sleeping with Jesse's son, but just being a roommate, but that's good enough. That's classic TV. Mm-hmm. But what if one of these characters had a soul? Like, what if someone actually engaged with people and, you know, in his own journey of like whether I can afford to do that, not financially, but in terms of my stature with my family or what I'm meant to be doing or whatever, was really fascinating. But there was a glimpse of a type of empathy or humanity that these other characters have willingly inoculated themselves against.
Yes.
And then with Kenny, I mean, that was remarkable for what that character was in the first season to what he's been this season, which has mostly been a joke in terms, not that the show has actually in no way disrespected his sobriety journey, which I think I really appreciate, but just in terms of like how he is perceived by Yaz and his awkwardness at times. What was so wild about what he came to say to her was that after all of this like pranking and joking and like forced frivolity with people who aren't actually your friends, to your point, what he had to say to her wasn't what I expected, which was just a choking back tears apology.
Yeah.
And has anyone ever spoken to Yasmin like that in her entire life? Certainly not her family. Certainly not her friends. You know, I can't imagine anything that would make her more uncomfortable than that. That was a wild thing.
Yeah, but it sort of speaks to what you're saying. It's like, you know, when else would Yaz be, if she doesn't want to talk to her father, she doesn't talk to her father. You know, if she doesn't want to talk to Harper, she doesn't talk to Harper. For like seemingly a year, she basically was out of Harper's life. but she has to like work this shit out with Kenny. Kenny like basically chases her down to the door to be like, I have to make amends with you in a sincere way, not in like a step way. It's really, really quite a scene.
Just the last thing, just like, if you compare that to Celeste, who like, in theory, like these people who are older mentors, right? Who, and actually the arrangement with wife, like I don't mean to lump in like whatever personal arrangements, that seems respectful and fine. I'm not trying to judge that, but like the way that she lives her professional life in terms of like, this night I'm just going to be, you know, high altitude alp skiing with billionaire clients, like that's just part of it, and sleeping with my underling, like this is all part of this world that we live in,
right?
Everything looks normal to these people. I mean, and I love the way the show comes at you sideways with that. Like when we saw Rishi in the parking lot, and I was like, what the other week? Like he's driving, was that like a Ferrari?
Yeah.
Or what? I don't know about cars. But
Porsche,
like,
yeah.
It's just like, excuse me? This is normal? This is what they're doing it for? You know, this is, or like walking into Yasmin's, you know, pied-à-terre in Berlin. Like everything looks normal when the universe is abnormal, it's normal.
Yeah.
So you have to live in it. And so these little cross cuts of just like, actually, this is what matters. Actually, this is how people ought to be communicating with each other. And again, it's still funny because it's Kenny. You know, I don't think that he's necessarily the paragon of human behavior, even at this more enlightened phase of his existence. But I it's hard to remember any other moment of just unadulterated emotion being expressed and being endured. And I'm curious what mark that leaves going forward.
Yeah. Well, we have two more episodes. Hopefully we'll be able to talk to Conrad and Mickey one more time after the finale. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
This episode is brought to you by Maybelline New York. Get ready to bring the heat with Maybelline's newest lip plumping gloss, Lifter Plump. Fair warning though, it's hot. Like, literally. It's formulated with chili peppers to bring a heated sensation and an instant plumping effect that lasts. Available in 8 sizzling shades like Blush Blaze, Hot Honey, and more. Buy Lifter Plump now on Amazon and use the code 10PLUMP to get 10% off for a limited time. Tap the banner to learn more.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
You want to talk about Reservation Dogs really quick?
Yeah, while we have our rave settings on high, we should talk about the other show that's probably the best of the year.
I was a little bit behind, and then I caught up to and through the episode that aired, I guess, Wednesday. You know, sometimes I'm almost like at a loss for words about this show, in the same way that I was sort of praising the way industry has handled, will handle like a very micro moment, specifically that Harper trade. I just thought that the way that Sterling Harjo has kind of managed A plot and B plot, for lack of a better term, and I'm hoping maybe you can give me the vocabulary that I need here. But like every episode feels like a short film or a world unto itself, a short story unto itself. But I can see where it's going in the novel of the lives of these mm-hmm. people. Even though if you ask me what season two of Reservation Dogs about, I wouldn't be able to say it's about whether or not they leave to go to California and how they get over the death of their friend. It's not one thing that it's about. Like if you were pitching this season, yeah. I'd be very curious to know what he said. The second season, it seems like the further adventures of these people. And yet every week you meet new people or find new parts of people that you've met, you know, already. Or you have the most amazing, like kind of emotional roller coaster. And I don't mean that in the like, oh my God, like the thrills and the chills that we experience, but just really confronting real life in like a head-on way. And no more, I can't think of a better example of that other than the episode Mabel, which is about Alora's grandmother passing away, which is just one of the most gorgeous pieces of TV I've seen in 5 years. I don't know. It's like kind of an arbitrary thing to say, but it's about as good as TV can get.
Yeah, this is the richest experience you can have on TV right now. And I think that if a lot of the shows that we've raved about this year, I mean, nothing on TV, especially in this era of consolidation and streaming, is safe. But like The Bear was always going to get renewed. Barry was always coming back for season four. If we are your Harper listeners and your Jesse Bloom, please trust us and spend some time and eyeball capital on Reservation Dogs. It is the biggest return on investment you could get. And it, speaking of things that are completely of this generation, Sterling Harjo, who's the creator and he writes and directs and, you know, the spiritual force behind the show. And I think he'll come back on the podcast at the end of the season, which I'm looking forward to. In a way, what he's doing reminds me of something more from when we were coming up. Like, do you remember like David Kelly before he became the prestige bard of people on the Upper East Side murdering each other? Like,
or Montecito.
He would just be like, yeah. Wait, coastal
yeah.
murder.
Yeah.
A bespoke
wait,
coastal
Wait, doesn't he
murder.
Also do Big Sky though?
Well, he created it, but our guy Elwood does it. Elwood
yeah,
Reed
but like, I mean, he's,
show, no.
I'm just saying he's like, whatever.
His body count is high.
Yes. Yes.
The thing about him used to be like, he came up under Bochco and then he would be like Ally McBeal or Picket Fences or Boston, whatever. And he'd just be like, cracks knuckles. Here's some things I have to say 22 hours later. You know what right. I mean? Like he would just write the shit out of all of it because he had so much stuff percolating that he wanted to work on and characters and scenes and ideas. This show feels like that, even though it is not, and I think Sterling would say this, like he has an incredible creative team with him. And this week's episode, which was focused on cheese, came directly from the life experience of one of his writers, Bobby Wilson, who was in a boy's home between the ages of 16 and 18 and poured all of that into this episode. But what I mean in terms of just like, I don't know what the show is about either, other than it is like taking your aux cord and plugging into the human experience for 30 minutes every week. But it's even better than that because it is absolutely not my experience. It is so specifically rooted in an experience that is literally miles and figuratively miles away from my own, but it gives me access to it in the most beautiful way, the way art is supposed to. This show is so almost effortlessly funny and character driven and affecting and sad. You were talking about the Mabel episode, which was, I agree, like that is a standout. And if you haven't watched the show, you could fire that up and be like, that's a great short film. I get it. I've never met these people. I don't know what fry bread is, but I get it.
Mm-hmm.
A week later, there's an episode about the moms and aunties going to a conference and eating edibles, you know, and it's a showcase for Sarah Podemski, who plays Bear's mom, who's fantastic. And I do need to claim her for my own tribe here. Apparently half Jewish. You love to see it. might be why she didn't get a call back for The Patient, coming back to that. It is so exciting to have a show in our lives that could be anything any week. And also just this community of it, right? Like Zahn McClarnon, who's just, you know, one of our great TV actors now, is starring in Dark Winds, right? on based on the Tony Hillerman books, and I think both of us checked it out, and I love seeing him in the leading role. He's clearly, because he's doing that, he's not available to be a star of the show. But you know, anytime Sterling picks up the bat phone, like, he's there. He's there to play big. He's there to play the part that is required in that episode. And so this week, like, Marc Maron shows up. Great performance by Marc Maron. Like, it's just...
Maron doing 12 steps with cheese is going to be, like, one of my favorite moments of TV of the year.
It's wild to me. It really makes you think about... I mean, casting is hard. Acting is hard. Making anything is hard. But, like...
What's Maron's whole thing where he's just like, not all cops are child molesters?
Child dibblers, yeah.
Morally dubious, yes.
But Chris, how are these guys able to go to Oklahoma and find amazing performers to play every single one of these roles up and down the line? You know, when people are like, oh, I couldn't find the right kid to play that part, or, you know, whatever. Like, I don't want to say try harder, but look what these guys are doing.
I know.
Week to week, the kids in the group home with Cheese himself. What? Why are these people capable of these performances? What alchemy is happening on the set of the show? It's so special. This is the one you probably get. Chris, you probably get this in your travels. People are like, what should I be watching? And you're like, oh boy. I just say Reservation Dogs.
It's just really great. I mean, it's just like, the thing is that, like, you don't have to qualify it with anything. There are some things where you're just like, oh, you might like this, but only if you're like, okay with like tremendous amounts of sex, drugs, and techno, or that for industry, or you might like this, but this guy's going to try and marry his young baby child off. You know what I mean? Like, there's all
Obi-Wan
sorts
Kenobi,
of like,
you're speaking
or,
of.
You know, there are all these caveats, but like with Reservation Dogs, I have no caveats. I have no... I can't think of a single person who wouldn't like it. It's funny, it's sad, it's real. Like, I just can't think of any reason why you would hang any kind of like condition on watching this show.
Also, last bit of gigantic praise for the show. You know, there was a moment, but it's been an ongoing moment for the last few years where if anyone ever bemoans the lack of a certain type of movie, not a medium, big movie, not like The Firm, but I mean, even indie movies, you know, where it's like, oh, here's a little slice of life or people talking and just how hard it is to get these movies made. And everyone's like, oh, they went to TV. Those are on TV now. Well, they were for a minute, but if they don't have an elf or a murder, they're not really getting greenlit, you know? And again, this kind of leans into what we're going to say about The Patient. Like, there isn't really room for that stuff, even on TV, unless maybe you backdoor it with Taika Waititi attached. Make it Reservation Dogs.
Right.
This is the heart and soul, and this is the world Sterling Harjo comes from, but this is the heart and soul of like independent cinema in the 90s.
This is what we were saying to him when he was on. It was like, this is more Linklater than it is anything else. You know what I mean? This is more just people hanging out and finding out who they are that's why I think the second season is amazing, because there isn't like a will they or won't they. There isn't a, you know, the clock is ticking. Will this happen in time? You know, it's
just that, oh, Jackie's hanging out with him now.
Yeah. Or they tried to go to California and they didn't, you know what I mean?
The Linklater thing is a great comp, because Linklater's movies at their best, like When Everybody Wants Some came out a few years ago, and you're just like basking in it for 2 hours. You're like, I wish I could live in this world. It's so fully detailed and realized. And oh my God, are these the six best new actors of their generation having the time of their lives? And then the movie ends. And some of those actors go on to be Superman on the CW, which is a great gig, but I miss seeing them. This is, that's every week.
Let's talk a little bit about The Patient, because that's also on FX on Hulu. For a show with Steve Carell and Donald Gleason, I think it's flying a little under the radar. I think maybe it's because... I think it's not that it's presenting itself as minor. When you weren't here, when I was talking... I think I was doing like an intro, and I think I almost said that this would have been a good Quibi show. You know, like the way in which it's conceived is as a chamber piece, as a two-hander. It's slightly expanding. You do have flashbacks, but essentially is these conversations between a therapist and a murderer in a very confined space. And while there are flourishes, like what's Donald Gleason going to bring Steve Carell to eat tonight? You know,
I love that.
It's pretty like anonymous, you know? I think that the characters are intentionally like almost not flat, but unadorned with references to the outside world, kind of, in a lot of ways.
It's small bore in a way that I really respect. At first, I was just confused. Like, this is... There's a case to be made that Steve Carell is the biggest TV star of our time, because The Office just continues to prove itself to be the most enduring and beloved show. Maybe show full stop, honestly, in terms of viewers over the last 20 years. People just, they love it, and they love him. He's back on TV, guys. Like, this is a leading role. And obviously,
this is the third show he's been on. It's the in the last, like, 5 years. It's Morning Show, Space Force, and this.
And then also this feeling of, like, if you had Steve Carell on a show made by Joe Weisberg and Joel Fields, great team that gave us one of the great shows also of the last few years, The Americans, why are you just kind of dumping it before Labor Day? It just felt very confusing.
Well, everything about this show is slightly... It's like a chessboard with the pawns in the back or something. It's just, even if you were, think about what you were going to do if this was an hour long drama and an 8 episode or 10 episode show.
Yes.
So you had to do, like, all, you know, you were going to do that kind of, like, 8 hour story. I don't think you would get to the Donal reveal of what's wrong until the end of the first episode, but that would be the end of the second episode or third episode in running time. You know, like,
I cannot agree with you more. I think what I thought was a series of strange minor miscues, the bug is the feature. The genius of this show, and what I really want to celebrate about the show, is it's the best use of the format that I can remember in quite some time. And we should have led with this. The episodes are 20 minutes long. Let me repeat that. The episodes are 20 minutes long. And what's thrilling about that isn't just the aforementioned 20 minutes long. It's that you can at once be alive to, you're aware of it because you know stuff's going to happen. But also, you, part of my brain, and I imagine most contemporary TV viewers are going to have a similar reaction. I'm having that same thought that you're having of the alternate history where this was bulked up. They started just spoon feeding the scripts creatine, and suddenly they're 57 minutes and there's tertiary characters and the big reveals happen later. That's not what this is or what it should be. I love seeing something be put in the right box. So suddenly, you're just laser-focused on two world-class actors doing really, really high-quality work. So maybe we buried it. The theme is Steve Carell is a therapist. He's seeing a patient who's not being very revealing. And then one night he gets kidnapped and he wakes up chained to a bed. And that patient, played by Donald Gleason, is like, now we can talk honestly. It wasn't working. You are my prisoner because I am a serial killer.
Right.
And I want you to help me. And I guess it's kind of a, I guess the log line then is it's like Mindhunter meets In Treatment.
Sure.
And I am kind of surprised how much I'm digging it because I am profoundly uninterested at this point in murder and serial killing. I feel pretty well versed in it. Love therapy, though.
Would you say you're more into murder? Mm-hmm. Power rank these three things for me, really.
Okay, yeah.
Murder.
Yep.
Therapy.
Yep.
Elves.
Wow. Well, therapy's a lifelong number one.
Okay.
I mean, that's just you know, it that's like RST, LN, and E in Wheel of Fortune. Like, it's just automatically on the board. Man. So murder or specifically being like serial killers asking, what's wrong with me? Why am I broken? That
well, I don't
is a
know.
Three.
You're the one who brought it up. I can't get enough murder, you know, well, in storytelling.
Like, I made a show that started with a murder. Like, I get that as a conceit, but serial killers being like, I live in the shadows. Like, I don't care about you guys anymore. I feel like you are overrepresented on television.
If Rosario Dawson had been played by Orlando Bloom, and it was the further adventures of Legolas, detective therapist. Do you think that you would be on like season 4 of Briar Patch right now?
Oh, without question. We would be simulcast on all of the NBC Universal Shine
Heart
networks.
If you had made an elf detective show, you would have been fucking printing money, man. You could have left this podcast behind.
But do you know what I wouldn't have innovated on? And this is what Rings of Power does that I really respect. It's that when you meet a blonde stranger, get real close and just brush their hair back over their ears and then be like, I fucking knew it. You know what I mean?
Oh,
that
yeah.
scene?
Yeah.
So what if Legolas is like a real tough-edged, pretty blonde, but tough-edged cop. You know what I mean? And he has a service bow strapped to his waist. But just like in the seedy Middle Earth Texas town, people just come real close and we're always touching his like the side of his hair.
And just be like, oh, just you're
ear check.
Yeah, you're one of those elf cops.
Okay, you're making a strong case for me. But I think that it's, so I guess it's an execution, no pun intended. Like, yeah. I would watch that show.
Yeah.
But the show that we do have, The Patient, does seem legitimately interested in how therapy works and how people talk to each other, which I love. We were joking about it earlier, so I have to bring it home. Like, I know why Steve Carell is in this show. Steve Carell is a great actor who deserves all the opportunities he is given. I love that he always wants to challenge himself. I think he's very good with stillness in this. I really am enjoying his performance. But he's not Alan Strauss. You know what I mean? Like, I understand they probably went out to all the Alan Strausses. I'm sorry. It's a little bit like, so Catherine Hahn gets bounced from playing Joan Rivers.
But give me an Alan Strauss alt then.
Judd Hirsch. Bang. Bang. Who doesn't watch that show? Look, I'm not here. I'm not going to make the argument because I understand that when Steve Carell answers your phone call, you say yes.
Yeah.
But in an era where representation matters, I'm doing the monocle emoji. You know what I mean? That's
I know what you mean.
I'm just doing the monocle
Somehow
emoji.
Somehow you knew that Bear's mom was Jewish, so you obviously are.
I got an alert. All of us in our tribe got an alert. I'm just saying, when Steve Carell in the early episode of The Patient walks into the pawn shop that's run by like the Hasidic Jews that his son is now a part of, and they're like, oi, here comes Alan. I was just like, yeah, because the goy's walking into the pawn shop. His son switched sides. And I'm like, well, clearly he was married to a cantor and Judaism is matriarchal. So I get it. And it's even weirder that he's not there. But then later, Donald Gleason is like, I saw many Jewish therapists. And I was like, did you run out of them? Is that what happened? I feel like that's a robust category, is yeah. all I'm saying. I'm not mad at it. I am truly, I'm enjoying the show
cool.
in the best
I just
way.
Like,
that
I like how they're
it.
Like, this is, I think that they are subtly doing some stuff that I wonder if even for these guys, it was based a little bit on their experience of doing The Americans for so long and not stretching it out by any means, but having like that experience writing that specific kind of show and then coming to this show and being like, you know what? It's not going to take three episodes to find out who that is walking upstairs. Yeah. It's his mom and she's coming to therapy too.
But I think it's more than that. I think it's also very, very smart. Maybe these guys have been to therapy too. Self-knowledge and self-awareness of what they're good at and what they're interested in. You know, and I think that choosing this format strips it down. They don't have to do the kind of curly cues and show-offy stuff and set pieces that really are necessary for a 55-minute new show to break through or get attention or get audiences. It's stripped down to what they do best. And in so doing, they've created something that is worthy of conversation, which I'm really impressed by. Like, just feel, listeners, search your feelings. The one podcast we didn't talk about Star Wars. And just ask yourself, like, if I told you there was a show about a therapist in session with a serial killer, and I told you that it was a new show to start watching now, feel the resistance within you.
Yeah.
Feel the fear and hate and suffering. And then when I tell you it's 20 minutes long, you feel that weight lift? Like the X-Wing fighter out of the swamp in Dagobah? Do you feel that? I do.
I want to let you cook for a second and talk a little bit about Paper Girls. I'll be completely honest. I watched the first episode of this show, which is only half an hour, right?
Oh, no. What, some of them are shorter. The pilot is only like 36 minutes, but other episodes stretch.
It's about half. It's 35 minutes. It felt much longer to me. And it completely lost me, not only in terms of like the machinations of like, some of the sci-fi elements that the show is about, but just there was something about, I mean, it's been quite a while because I watched that first episode ages ago. It feels like there was something about it that just didn't click with me, I guess I could just say it. Why don't you tell me, because you watched the entire season. Tell me about what I missed.
So this is an interesting one to me because the comic book, Paper Girls.
And this is a show, it's on Amazon, the entire season is up? Right.
The entire season is up now. The comic book is finished publication. It's by the great Brian K. Vaughan, who we've talked about. And I think Brian came on the pod once to talk about Runaways with Josh and Stephanie. He's a really good guy. He created Runaways. He created Saga, created Why the Last Man. Celebrated as one of the great comic book writers of our time. He made this with the great artist Cliff Chang. And it is really joyful, self-contained story about four paper girls. They deliver newspapers in the Cleveland suburbs in the 80s. And then they get swept up into a generation-spanning time war. And there are giant robot kaiju and dinosaurs and laser guns and all sorts of things. But it's also a very tender and well-observed coming-of-age story for these four young women. And very high-profile project, obviously going into other medium. Brad Pitt's company, Plan B, developed it, brought it to Amazon. The Chrises, Chris Rogers and Chris Cantwell, who made Halt and Catch Fire, are executive producers of the series, not showrunners. And it came and it kind of came out. Mm-hmm. And it slipped under our radar. You checked it out. I didn't quite get to it. And this is a tough recommend because it is not to everyone's taste. It is not entirely successful. I feel like it's okay to say that. It's one of those things that I'm really happy exists. And I really encourage people to watch because its heart is so much in the right place. It executes certain things so well. The four young women cast in the show are exceptional. That's so hard to do. The show really smartly understands that what is going to make this a success or failure is the relationship between them and the emotional stakes of being a young person and unsure of yourself and then learning about who you're going to be, not on the traditional ways of going through life, but literally seeing future versions of yourself. Mm-hmm. One character's future version is played by Ali Wong in a really surprising and great dramatic turn. The show gets so close. And I'm with you on the pilot, because I think the pilot is the worst episode of them. It looks beautiful. I got to shout out my guy, Zach Galler, who was the DP on Briar Patch, shot it as well. So I'm obviously predisposed to like it, but I think he did a great job. The show often seems confused as to what it wants to be, because the thing about Brian Vaughan's comics is, like other people I've talked about on the pod, like Grant Morrison, like Brian Vaughan writes comics because he loves comics. And he knows that in comics, you can put a giant time traveling robot next to a dinosaur and be like, give it to me, give me more. But on TV, that's a little bit of a harder sell. And so you feel the pilot being like, how are we going to convince people used to a certain type of entertainment that these four girls are also going to be the stars of Stranger Things, but also lasers?
Right.
Like it's a lot. And it's a lot to get you there. And it calms down pretty smartly after that and figures itself out around three or four.
I think that was sort of the thing that was tripping me up was when it got like, I wouldn't even say hard sci-fi, but when it was like, there's a war in the future. And like, there was like an element of it where I was just like, what the hell is happening?
I don't blame you for that. And I think the show itself doesn't ever fully make peace with that, including to the end. Cause I was watching it through, it was getting better and better and better. Friend of the pod, our beloved Jason Manzoukas, shows up as one of the big bads, which is just really cool and a great choice. And I was like, I'm really excited though, because I think it's figured itself out and it's going to end in a really kind and respectful way. And the season ends, I should warn people, with just a hard pivot to a future season. And there's enough story in the comics for that. But I don't know if the response and the ratings have been robust enough to give it the second season it deserves. And my main feeling about that is just disappointment, because I'm just going to say their names. Cameron Jones, Riley Lai Nellett, Sophia Rosinski, Fina Straza. These young actors are so good. They're amazing. And it made me sad that they're not going to get to play these parts again. And I just thought it was an interesting test case, especially the same week that we're talking about House of the Dragon and we're talking about Rings of Power, of a show that, to me, was more emotionally successful than Stranger Things. I'm not saying it's a more successful show. It is clearly not in terms of eyeballs or finances or return on investment or entertainment value even. They're not trying to do the same things, even though whenever you talk about kids in the 80s riding bikes, you're kind of in the same
Amblin
universe.
Can you define what you mean by emotionally successful? I mean, just because I have watched Stranger Things and I think that it has its high watermarks and its low watermarks, but...
Yeah, I didn't mean to ding it.
I was just curious obviously you mean it for you, but what do you mean by emotionally successful?
I just mean that the show... These four young women begin in very different places, like one character, and kind of cookie cutter places. Like there's the child of immigrants who's struggling to fit in. There's the girl who comes from a very hard scrabble and violent household who carries that resentment forward and unleashes it on people. There's the person, there's the young woman who comes from a family like Dr. Alan Strauss, if I may be broad, who is struggling with her own identity and anger and sexuality. There's the young black woman who is brilliant and not really recognized for it. And then it puts them, and they're not really friends. They're coworkers. They deliver newspapers
together.
That's
right. It's a workplace drama. Yeah.
In an incredibly high stakes, absurd situation. And then just leaves them there so that when they collide, and, you know, conflict is what fuels all these shows, whether it's a time war or not, it just feels really emotionally honest and true to a 12, 13-year-old experience. Mm-hmm. And I really like the reactions of 12-year-old girls to their adult selves who disappoint them. You know, I just thought it was really, it just really stayed focused on that. I just keep wanting to say its heart is in the right place. And I just feel like it's worth celebrating at a time when, look, and we have many episodes left and seasons left to debate the relative success creatively of House of the Dragon. It's absolutely without question successful from a network perspective. But there's a feeling to me of it that it's successful because it's safe. You know, it is safe in the sense that they're like, these are the people who know how to do Thrones. George Martin is back in there. And so they're getting all the little things right. Like George Martin being like, finally, you know, medieval hunting is being represented the way I intended it to be represented. Right. And it's just like, George, Game of Thrones is the most popular show of the century. Nobody was mad about the hunting scene in season one. Like, that's not the problem.
But it's his attention to detail that people respond to.
I guess, but it was also Benioff and Weiss being like, here are human beings.
He's the one who's like, it's important. Like, what's his whole thing? It's like, when I read Tolkien, I want to know what Aragorn's tax collection strategy is, right? That was his pitch, which like what he wanted. And it's
do you
like,
think he understands shorting? Does he understand finance?
We should pitch Mickey and Conrad on the elvish version of industry.
But you're absolutely right that it's which detail are you more focused on. And I think that for contemporary viewers, and I don't know anything about the backstory, what went on behind the scenes, but contemporary network executives, there was probably friction within Paper Girls where people were like, but wait, who is this, the old watch and the time variant? I mean, it's basically the plot of Loki.
Yeah.
In the sense that there are people who are like, we have to fix the timeline. And there are people being like, fuck it, we should make things better for people. Okay. And I really appreciated when Paper Girls was just like, that'll work itself out. What makes successful entertainment and what made the comic book good is you could be like, yeah, there's a dinosaur eating a guy, but one of these girls might like another girl. And what's that like for her? And right. That's the detail we're focused on. And I may be in some ways overrating the show because it stumbled, but that's where it was headed. And it's a bummer to me when work with good intention and a lot of good execution just doesn't quite come together. And thus, with this steamroller of a culture we live in, is just...
But it's interesting.
I haven't seen anyone talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, I think that... I mean, I wonder how many people were like, the first episode just wasn't right for me.
The first episode was a struggle for me, too. And
well,
then,
I'll get back into it when I can pull myself out of the luxurious world of Irish interior design of Bad Sisters. I will try to detach from that and check it out.
What if all these shows just became one singularity show for us? I'm pretty into like Irish elves tax collecting, but also murdering in therapy.
So we'll be back, what, Sunday night?
Are you asking me?
I mean,
calendar?
I'm taking the temperature. Sunday night, we'll be back with our House of the Dragon chat, and maybe we'll do a little bit of a more in-depth Lord of the Rings stuff off that. And we were
I'm into Sunday nights being... fantasy. We can cover this stuff. We can get into it.
Yeah. Hard sci-fi, hard fantasy, high fantasy that, Sundays.
That with two 45-year-old men.
Carrie Underwood to sing our theme song. All the elves are here for Sunday night.
It's great stuff.
We were produced by Kaya McMullen. We'll see you guys on Sunday night.